going down the test, and we're going to look at certain characteristics. And whereas I've been comparing them as we've gone along, now you're going to see them all in one particular area. What it's saying is, as you take the test, this is what an organizer does. Organizers enjoy organizing things. They enjoy organizing. They like organizing. Organizers assume a leadership role if none exist. But that reminds me, this word organizer at the top, sometimes if you're listening to some people or you're reading some types of material, they will call an organizer an administrator. Same word, I mean different word, but it means the same thing. It's just called something different. So organizer, administrator, same topic. Like long-range projects, number three. That is another characteristic of an organizer that's very important. One of the differences between the two physical people, the organizer and the server, is that the organizer likes long-term projects. They like planning out something that's 4 or 5 years, and they love the joy that comes from completing it, but they like long-term projects. Number four, find it easy to develop resources to accomplish tasks. That's one of the key elements, again, about an organizer. They can take all of these sources or resources around them, and they can use these resources to get something done. Perfect biblical example of this is Nehemiah in the book of Nehemiah in the Old Testament. Remember how Nehemiah was sent by the king to go to Jerusalem, which had been destroyed in 586. Now it's some 70 more years later. And he gets to the city and the wall's been completely destroyed. The people are living in half in poverty. And he understands that these walls are important for defending the people against invaders, but from also from wild animals. And so one of the things it says in the book of Nehemiah, and he's an organizer, perfect example of an organizer is Nehemiah. What it says about him is that very first day he went out when nobody else was paying attention to him, and he rode around the city, and he assessed what was going on around the city. In other words, where everything was at, where the resources were, what resources he could use, and what resources he could depend on. In other words, there's rocks over here that I could use, there's reinforcement concrete or something like that I can use here, or do the people live here or no people live here. He looked around at what needed to be done. He looked at the resources that were available, and this is what the organizer does, and this is the kinds of questions, and this is what the purpose of the questions are being asked about the organizer, to help you determine whether you're an organizer or not. They're quick to evaluate situations and make firm decisions. They don't vacillate like a prophet. They don't vacillate like a mercy. They can make a quick decision and carry through with it. Remember how we talked about that instinctive part about writing notes? Number eight, they write notes. Okay, most of those are self-explanatory. Are there any questions under the organizer that you do not understand or you want me to elaborate on or talk more fully about? Anything just in that one, that first 15 questions that you're not sure what it's talking about or what it's asking about? On 12, develop outer callousness because of criticism. Do you understand what that means? I mean, they can take criticism, and they don't like being criticized, and they get angry at the people that criticize them, but after a while, they just get very insensitive to it. So as you're answering the question, you say to yourself, does it hurt me when people criticize me? And then after a while, I just get insensitive. That's what it's asking about. Okay, let's take the next section. The exhorters. They love to encourage others to live victoriously. That's something we've talked about. Number 17, we haven't said much about, but exhorters tend to be perfectionists in this respect. They expect a lot of themselves, and they also expect a lot of others. And so you go and talk to an exhorter, and exhorter understands where you're at and what your needs are, and they will say to you, you need to do this, 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 and this. And you go away, and you don't do it, and you come back a couple weeks later, or you see them a couple of weeks later and they say, did you do any of those things? And you say no, they're going to get angry. You didn't do them. You said you wanted help and you didn't do them. They're going to get angry. So when you're reading that question, that's what it's talking about when it's talking about expecting a lot of others. Number 20, exhorters don't like to think of themselves as being dishonest. They don't like to think of themselves as turning the truth. But the problem is they tend to bend the truth around the facts sometimes. And so I know most of you didn't bother who were exhorters to check that, but that is something, if you're really honest with yourself, is sometimes you bend the facts a little bit. Again, 21, that goes back to this talking to people face-to-face, this face-to-face conversation. What the question is addressing is it's just not talking to a person face-to-face. It's when you look in their face, you look in their eyes, and you can read what's going on in their souls by what's in their eyes. Exhorters can do that. So if you're not an exhorter and you're immoral or something, shut your eyes. That's the thing you need to do. Okay, no. They read your nonverbal behavior. And so this is what that question is getting at. Do you have this ability, when you look at a person, to observe their behavior, to observe their eyes, and see what's going on with them? And are you able to determine what their level of maturity is by what you see? 23, again, was those precise steps of action when you're speaking to people. They come to you, I got a problem. Well, do 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and you'll get better. Don't do 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and you'll get worse. And don't mix them up. That's something that an exhorter pays attention to. Just say, I want you to do step 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. They want you to do it in that order, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. They don't want you to do step 3 and then step 4 and leave 2 out if you don't like doing it. They don't like that sort of thing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Any questions under the exhorter that you want me to elaborate on, that you're wondering about, or what it means? Able to discern the maturity of another person. Obviously, one thing about an exhorter is the older you get, the wiser you get. The older you get, the easier it becomes to discern a person's maturity. Well, if you're 20 years old, it's going to be very difficult to discern the maturity of a 50-year-old person. They're older and it's hard. You're not there. You haven't got there, so it's pretty hard to do that. But the 20-year-old exhorter can discern the maturity of a 10-year-old, of a 12-year-old, of a 15-year-old, of an 18-year-old, or even other 20-year-olds. They can discern the maturity of those people, particularly who haven't got to the level that they are yet. Number 27, exhorters had this real need inside to clear up problems with other people. Now, guess what? Servers don't like that a bit. They don't like it at all, in fact. In fact is, just say you've hurt the feelings of a server, whether you're married to them or they're your child or whatever, you've hurt their feelings. And you as an exhorter want to go to that server and say, look, let's talk about the problem. I'm sorry for what I did, or I shouldn't have done what I did, or some other things. The server turns her face away from you. They want to walk away, but they don't want to be too rude. And they may well say, let's talk about something else. I don't want to talk about this subject. Well, one thing that exhorter wants to do is they want to talk about the problem. They had to get it out. And, of course, number 29, they talk too much. And that's what I do. I talk too much. But because they talk, number 30 is also true. They have a tendency to break confidentialities, which is a real problem. Real problem if you're going to an exhorter for counseling. And a real problem for the exhorter if they don't pay attention to the fact that they can't do that. A person tells an exhorter something about themselves, the exhorter has to learn the importance of keeping their mouth shut about what that person said. Okay, that's the exhorter. Again, what I'm doing is I'm superficially looking at these qualities. Now we're looking at more and more characteristics or qualities under each one. Again, we're doing it so that we can get a larger and larger view so that we can get more intense about what we're looking at. Mercies. Mercies have this ability to sense genuine love on the other, on the part of other people. In fact, there's something else that a mercy does that I'd like to describe for you. The mercy, most people like mercies. They like being around mercies because they make them feel better. They take the pain off of them. Because of that, people tend to think that they're good friends with a mercy. It ain't so. A mercy only has two or three close friends in their whole life. Rarely do you find a mercy that has a close friend or more than one at a time, and rarely do they have more than two or three throughout their whole life. Well, what about all these other people who think they're friends? Well, they're not. What they are, from the mercy's point of view, is they're an acquaintance. So what you have with mercy is you have this huge circle, and then in the center you have a tiny circle. It seems that a lot of people can get through this outer circle. The mercy will allow or become vulnerable to a lot of people, and they'll work with these people. They'll talk to them, listen to their problems. They'll be somewhat vulnerable to them. And people, because of that, think that they're friends. But it's only a very select few that ever really get into the heart of a mercy. And a mercy is very careful about who they allow in. That's not something really negative about a mercy, but it is important to know about a mercy. That if you really want to be a close friend to one, you're going to have to make your own self very vulnerable, which means there are not too many prophets that get that close to mercies, are there? Well, after 30 years of marriage, you have a chance, but it usually takes a while. But question number 32, you feel vulnerable and easily hurt. Mercies feel that. At least 30% of this audience are mercies. You're very emotional people. It's very easy for you to get your emotions or get your feelings hurt. The trouble is you don't want to tell anybody they're hurt, because then you'd be hurting the other person. So you keep your mouth shut. Another problem. 33, they're attracted to people who are hurting or in distress. There's an example for mercy that you may be familiar with or you may not be. And I understand that because this is being filmed in some places, what I'm about to give you as an example may be available or may not be available. But for you who are aware of what I'm talking about or like this sort of thing, that's something to keep in mind. Are there any Star Trek fans in here? Raise your hand. No Star Trek fans? Two or three? Well, now we're talking about the first generation Star Trek. There was an episode, I think there was a total of 168 episodes of Star Trek in the first generation, but there was an episode among those first 168 that must have been written by a mercy, because as you watch that episode, it is exactly what a mercy does. But the neat thing about that film is it gives you some idea what their potential is. The name of that movie, and I don't know, all of you rush over to Blockbuster to get a copy of it right now, but the name of that episode was called The Empath. And in this particular episode, these characters on this foreign planet, alien planet, the doctor's there, and Captain Kirk and Scotty, I think, and this woman is there laying on this couch when they're all beamed down against their will to this planet, and they got these people over here who are doing the beaming down, and this woman's laying over there crying. She can't talk, and they learn later that she can't talk. She has no ability to talk. But then the aliens explain to Captain Kirk and Scotty and the doctor that the reason that they beamed them there is because this woman lives on a planet where what she does, her ability, is direly needed, because people like her had this ability to drain the pain off of other people. Only this woman hasn't learned how to do that. And they need to use them as guinea pigs to show her how to do that. That's what the episode is all about. At the end of the episode, or near the end of the episode, what happens is the doctor's the one that gets the dirty end of the stick, and they strike him with a very painful disease. And they explain to the woman, you're the only one that can save the doctor. And they motivate her to do that. And so she walks over, crawls over, I forget exactly how she gets over, and she touches the doctor. And as she touches the doctor, the doctor's painful boils and sores on the outside start to shift from the doctor to the woman. And she just drains all of this infection off of him. And the doctor gets well, and she's laying there with all these sores on her. She got them off of him. And then the sores disappear with her. After they beam her back to her planet, they explained to them why it was so important. The woman had to do it for the first time. And once she did it, she learned how to do it. Believe me, that is every bit as true of what happens with a mercy as anything I know. A person who's a mercy, who loves God, who practices being a mercy, who does not waste their energy feeling sorry for themselves or feeling oversensitive about people hurting their feelings, but they completely devote their abilities and power to God. It is amazing. These mercies can walk into a room of a very, very sick person and sit down beside them and take their hand and start praying for them or just being there with them. And the pain, they just drain the pain off of that person. And they walk away, and the person laying there, and they physically feel better. They emotionally feel better. Gee, you talk about wanting a gift of healing. That is a real gift. And it's amazing is that 30% of this audience are mercies, and that is the potential as a mercy that you have. The degree to which you're willing to surrender your spirits to God. The willingness to get all of Satan and all those things out of your life and be a righteous person and then turn over to God all those super sensitive feelings when you get hurt and just leaving them alone and giving up anger. And then what God does inside is he develops this ability to heal other people. Not in some of the ways that we see it on TV or some of the ways that other people do it, but it's just amazing if you're an observer and you watch this happening, it's amazing how the person feels. I know that after my mother died, that was a very difficult time for me. My mother was a very godly person, and I depended heavily on her for her spiritual advice. She taught me to pray at a very, very young age, and she was the type of person that believed that the answer, and just like it says in the book of James, person desires wisdom, God gives it to you. Well, she was that kind of person. That's how she taught her children to pray. Well, when she died, there was a dependency on my part and being able to look, I got a problem, mother. I need you to pray about it. Well, she was gone. I was very much aware of those feelings and feeling that vulnerability. And I went to work a few days after the funeral, and there was this person there who I hadn't had much contact with. He was a good person. I just hadn't had much contact with him. And he came over, and he put his hand on my shoulder. And I'm a type of person, at least to that point, I didn't like people to touch me. People at a distance. He put his hand on my shoulder, and I'll tell you, I felt something inside of myself that I'd never felt before. I could feel something in his touch. I don't remember exactly the words that he said now, but they were the most comforting words that I've ever heard in my whole life. And I realized in that time, and in what he said, something very important in life, God has given some people a very important gift in this mercy. And if there was some way I could motivate you or encourage you to set aside the super sensitive feelings that you have a tendency to get into and say, Lord, I don't care what people hurt my feelings. It doesn't make any difference anymore. Only thing that's important, Lord, is that I'm your servant. Only thing that's important, I'm sorry I'm preaching about all this, but there's just something about a mercy that turns me on. I'm not a mercy, I'm an exhorter. But there's just something about that power that they possess. And if there's some way that I can motivate you, if you have that gift, to start using it, believe me, the people around you will adore you for it. They need it. That's why God created so many. 30% of the population have this gift. There's no telling how many of them waste it. His purity wasted. They wasted on themselves. Selfish, self-centered thinking. They wasted on themselves. Okay, I'll quit preaching. That's not what I'm here for. I get carried away sometimes. Well, what's next for the mercy? Number 37, they avoid conflicts and confrontations. Mercies do not like confrontations. They're peacemakers, they're mediators, and if two people are arguing and fighting, they want to step between them and stop the fighting. It's like the example that I gave you about the little 18-month-old girl getting up in her parents' laps and wiping off the tears. They want people to feel better. They are interested, mercies are interested in people's feelings, more in their feelings than what's going on physically. They're not insensitive to physical things. It's just that if you have two people here, one who's suffering physically and one who's suffering emotionally, their first charge is going to be the emotional person. They're going to be attracted most strongly to the emotionally suffering person. They tend to be slow. Remember I told you they're going to be late to their own funeral? They tend to be very slow. They talk so. Remember I told you that I'd explain to you why they were slow? How can you possibly... I mean, you take a server, very fast physically. They get a lot done. And we're blessed with servers. And we'll talk about some of those ways in a little bit. But I'll tell you, if you got somebody working real fast around you, there's no way in the world that person's going to know if you're upset about something. They're getting things physically done, but they have no idea that you're crying inside. The mercy is slow because their radar is working. They got this mercy radar and it's going back and forth. If it were standing up here, it'd be going back and forth. Remember in that last session, I could see in the woman's eyes, well, in fact, she was a mercy. You could see it in her eyes, how emotional she was. Exhorters can see that. Servers ignore it because they don't like the pain. But the mercy can sense the person in a very fine, unique way that is feeling emotional. And so they sit down beside them and tell me about it. It's okay to cry. Tell me about it. And you just dump it all right there. Let me say something about the person that's being dumped on, the mercy. God never intended for the mercy to play God. Never. A mercy plays God when they walk away and they don't give the pain and anguish that they took off of the other person to God. God never intended for the mercy to hold on to it, to keep it. He wants the mercies to immediately turn the pain over to Him. That's what Jesus came for. When you look at Isaiah chapter 52, chapter 53, that's what His whole purpose in life was to take our pain and our anguish. And one of the things He uses mercies for is to help that process. But they're supposed to give it to Jesus. Okay, I think I got my point across. 39, trusting and trustworthy. Mercies tend to be very trusting of other people. In fact, they tend to be very naive. They find it somewhat difficult at times to realize that people are using for the purpose of misusing, and that can get them in trouble. Mercies are ruled by their heart. They're ruled by their feelings, not by their intellect. And so if a teacher who's intellectual is talking to a mercy, what are they going to do? Well, let me point out to you, the teacher says, this is all the rational reasons why you ought to do the following stuff. And the mercy says, I don't care about what the rational reason is. This is what I feel. And the two can't seem to communicate. No, they don't. One's a mercy, and they're talking about feelings. The other's an intellect, and they will never understand the person who feels. 44, tend to avoid giving discipline, a real weakness on the part of the mercy. They find it very difficult to discipline their children. It's very hard to do that. Why? They don't want to hurt their feelings. They're terribly afraid of ruining that child forever because they spank them. They just don't like doing it. The prophet doesn't bother them a bit. 46, they react to the idea that God allows a good person to suffer. Some of the most strongest or most difficult problems that I have in counseling is when I have a mercy come in, sit down, and say, I had a 2 or 3 year old child. This child was the light of my life. and the child was playing in the driveway, and the father or my husband backed the car up over the child and killed it. It's been 2 years since that happened. I still can't forgive him for doing that, and I still feel this loss. And I'll tell you, I don't believe there's a God, because a God wouldn't allow that to happen. Isn't that what a mercy would say? How can a God allow all this suffering to go on? Those are the kinds of things that come out of a mercy's mouth, because they hate anguish and pain so much. It makes it very difficult for them to learn to reconcile that with a kind, merciful God. And so they have to learn the hard way. Okay, that's the mercy. The prophet easily perceives the true character of others around them. Yeah, they walk into a room, there's anybody that's immoral or thief or particularly insincere, they pick them out right out of the crowd. And they don't mind letting them know it either. You hypocrite. How could you stand there? What are you doing in here with these Christians? You hypocrite. Can't you hear them saying that? But also, question number 49, they're open with others about their own failures. They don't mind letting another know, look, I made a mistake here. I was wrong. I sinned against you, and I want to ask you to forgive me. They'll do that. Spur of a moment. Remember Peter? How Peter would vacillate from one extreme to another. Peter, in fact, he even got on the wrong side of Jesus one time, and Jesus said to him, get behind me, Satan, and Peter immediately shifts and goes to the other side. Well, prophets have that tendency. They vacillate between back and forth. 51, they tend to make quick judgments. They are quite certain about what's right and wrong, and they're quite certain they're going to let you know what it is. 52, usually speak first, and they're very persuasive. If you are, just say you're on a debate team, and you found out that the person that you're debating against is a prophet, you might as well concede and just forget it. You don't have a chance. They're very persuasive people. And when they're Christians and they're following God's will, who was it that that the Lord chose for the day of Pentecost to do the first speaking? First, blunt, persuasive. Peter. He stood up there and he baptized 3,000 of them. First sermon. They're very quick about doing that. Very quick about convicting people of wrong. But they sense insincerity and they usually react very harshly to that. They tend to be blunt, like we've talked about. 58, they tend to overreact to people who are wrong. And this is a real weakness on their part. They see that you're doing something that's wrong. They come to you, they lower the boom, they hit you over the head with a hammer, and then they go back in the backyard and get a sledgehammer, and they come back and hit you a few more times. They want you to know that you've sinned, that you're wrong, and they expect you to change. And so they have this real tendency to overreact, and you feel like you've been beaten in the ground by the time they get finished. But you also know that you've done something wrong. But there's that overreaction there. And then mixed with that is question 59, impulsive, and vacillates. They go back and forth between extremes. They go this way, they go that way. Their moods have a lot to do with that. It's not that they don't know what's right and wrong. That's not what's going back and forth. But it's that they change their directions and they sometimes confuse you. Or try to. Any questions so far about the organizer, exhorter, mercy, or prophet that I need to illuminate? Yes.
What are the examples of exhorter and mercy?
The examples you want characters. You want people. Okay. Let's go down the list. We'll just be real organized about this. A couple of examples for the organizer. Nehemiah, we've already said. Joseph, we've alluded to, as also being an excellent organizer. Both of those were examples of organizers. Exhorters, somebody argued with me last night about it, but Paul's an example from my point of view from an exhorter. Many people would say he's an example of a teacher because he writes so much. And because, 13 and half the New Testament is written by Paul. But if you start looking real closely at those epistles, he doesn't go from one logical point to another. He'll talk about something for 3 or 4 verses, and all of a sudden, he'll shift his point of view and is talking about something else completely different. Particularly if you look at the book of Philippians, 1 minute he's talking about loving and being kind to one another, next time he's talking about the dogs, or you people are acting like a bunch of dogs, and then he goes and shifts his point of view again. Well, teachers don't do that. Teachers do something quite, they're very organized and meticulous and particular. So that's why I think Paul is an exhorter. Mercy. John is an example of a mercy. A couple reasons. One, because as you read the book, mercy's like reading the book, but as you read the book, there's so much feeling and sensitivity there. But you remember as they were coming down and the Samaritans, they had a set to with the Samaritans, and how angry John got with them? It was because they were attacking Jesus. Jesus was his friend, and he got furious with them. Mercies do that. They don't like people attacking their friends. So that's why I think John's a mercy. Prophets. Well, we've already said Peter's a prophet. Elijah is a perfect example of a prophet. Elijah was a prophet. And then John the Baptist was a prophet. Remember he got his head taken off? Why did he get his head taken off? Well, he said somebody was committing adultery. And they just took his head right off. Well, he was very blunt about that, wasn't it? Perfect example. You see, as you start reading these examples and these people and you start seeing it from the gift, from the motivational gift, then it makes sense. Why would a man stand up there and say that knowing that he's going to get killed? Well, right and wrong's right and wrong's wrong, and you don't take your brother's sister's wife. You just don't do that. Okay, prophet, I gave you three of them. Teacher, who's an example of the teacher? Luke, who wrote both Luke and Acts. And what you find in those books are very meticulous, chronological, sequential types of writing. If you're able to read Greek, then you see it even more clearly. He uses one of the highest levels of Greek, of classical Greek, in his writing. Very excellent at Greek. He's a teacher. Very meticulous. Whoever wrote the book of Hebrews was probably a teacher, because they write in that same format. Some people say Luke did, other people say Apollos did, other people are real smart and say, I don't have the slightest idea who did. I don't think Paul wrote it, because Paul's writing is somewhat different. He's the exhorter, he's encouraging, he's doing that, whereas the writer of Hebrews is very meticulous. He exhorts every once in a while, but he's very meticulous. Server. Who's a server? The Bible mentions this person a lot, but they don't give you very much detail about a person, about this particular person. But Timothy was a server. One of the traits or characteristics about a server is that they tend to have a lot of stomach problems. And the reason they do, they're physical people, and what do they do with the emotions? Their anger, their anxiety, they stuff it down inside. And what's down here? The stomach. And that's where it gets it all. And so one of the things Paul said to Timothy was, take a little wine for your stomach's sake. That's where he was stuffing all those emotions. Well, there's some other things that he says to Timothy that gives you the idea, but Timothy was probably a server. But there's a woman who's a server who's even a better example. Anybody know who that was? Martha, Martha. Remember? You're worried about all these little details, Martha. She's a server. Perfect example. Who said Martha? Who knew that? Were you a server? Are you a server? Yep, you can recognize it. Okay. The last one on the list is giver. Of course, there's no biblical examples of giver. Is that true or false? Matthew was a giver. It is very interesting when you start reading the book of Matthew. One of the things you discover about this gospel, you're reading along, he's the only gospel writer who talks about not letting your left hand know what your right hand's doing. Isn't that being secretive? You look at all the stuff that he talks about as far as money's concerned. What was Matthew's occupation? Come on, y'all know the Bible. What was this? Okay. Matthew is an example of a giver. In two or three sessions from now, we're going to talk about some very specific things about the giver that's very important, that comes strictly from the book of Matthew. But Matthew is a perfect example of a giver. And as I've already said, Moses was possibly either a server or a giver. Probably a server, but could have been a giver. Why? Because givers mask themselves as servers sometimes, right? Do you remember that? Givers hide and they mask themselves as servers, right? Everybody remember that? Okay. Why that's important is because frequent or once in a while when you're talking to servers or you're talking to a person and you cannot figure out what their gift is, if a little light bulb goes on inside and says, if I can't figure it out, maybe they're a giver. Frequently that could be true. Okay, where did we stop? Were there any other questions? Okay, let's go down to this. No, we can't skip the teacher because I know on question 70 that I can't tell you the number of times that I get a sheet of paper back and 70 is left blank. And I ask the people, why did you leave 70 blank? And they say, I don't know what it means to be legalistic or dogmatic. Well, that's because you act that way. No, Pharisees are a perfect example of being legalistic or dogmatic. Let's go back up to the first part on their teacher. Teachers present information in a logical, orderly manner. Luke starts out in the very beginning. He's writing and saying why he's writing. He gives a purpose sentence, and then he proceeds to do that. They validate information by checking out the facts. Let me tell you, I know there's some teachers in this auditorium, and I do not know why you have failed to do something. But I'd like to give you an example. Teachers have this real need to know by what right you have to speak. One of their weaknesses, they put a lot of emphasis on a person's degrees, but they want to know by what right you have to speak. And until they know that, they don't listen to you. So let me give you an example from something that took place a couple years ago when I was teaching the gifts on a Wednesday night in this congregation. And I was rolling along, talking about it. People were getting excited. I could see their smiles just like yours because it's enjoyable hearing about them, especially if you've never heard about them before. We were talking, and I looked over, and the minister was sitting over there. And out of my peripheral vision, he was shaking his head. I mean, all through that session, he was shaking his head. No, no, no. I don't believe a word you're saying. No, I could see it in his eyes. He was a teacher. I knew he was a teacher, and I made a mistake. I'll get to what the mistake was in a minute. So at the end of the session, he walks down the aisle. He's serious as he can be. He gets within 10 feet of me, and I says, I bet you're a teacher, aren't you? He says, well, I don't know if that's true or not, but the real truth of the matter is, the reason I'm here is, what is your qualifications for talking about this? Well, where'd you go to school? I went to, and then he named off the school that he went to. And I think the spirit really prompted me with something in that moment in time that was really humorous. You will never have guessed what it is, but you'll find it humorous after you know. And I said, Fred, his name was Fred, by the way. I said, Fred, it just so happens that I went to the same school you did. And in fact, Fred, I used to grade your Hebrew papers. And I think that guy could have fainted. And he said, I know who you are. You graded my Hebrew. You did do that, didn't you? I said, yes, I did. And, oh, what you've been talking about is the most interesting thing I have ever heard. I've never heard this stuff before. All of a sudden, the whole thing changed. That's what teachers are like. Once you've qualified yourself as a speaker, gee whiz, they'll listen to you. Until you do that, they don't do it. And, of course, I didn't qualify myself as a speaker. I didn't bother to tell you how I was qualified. And I guess it's just too late now, but if you have to know, you can come and ask me. Otherwise, it just doesn't make any difference, does it? Obviously, I know what I'm talking about. Or I think I know what I'm talking about anyway. Or at least you think you know that I know what I'm thinking about. Okay. That's an example for a teacher. The other thing about teachers are that they are, come on, repetitive. They repeat themselves. They keep doing the same things over and over again. Why do they do that? Because they want you to learn. And so they don't mind repeating themselves, even if it is a boring joke. 66. Emotionally self-controlled and self-disciplined. Self-controlled. They are not emotional people. They stand up here. They speak. And there's not a sign of emotion on their face at all. Unless... I'll tell you what really gets a teacher excited when they know something you don't know. If they can teach you something you don't know, it makes their day. And I told you in two sessions ago that I would give you or act like some of these. It's hard for me to act like a server, but I can be a teacher. I can act like a teacher. So let me give you an example. Let's see how many know the answer. This is typical of a teacher now. Most of you are familiar with birthdays, right? And you're familiar that there's cards that are made that say, I mean, you were born on December 14, 1943, and so they go back and tell you everything that's happened in history on December 14, 1943. Everybody's familiar with those cards. If there's somebody here that's not familiar with those cards, raise your hand and I'll explain a little bit further. Okay, everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? Okay. In Genesis, when Noah and the flood is about to take place, and the rain starts to fall, what is significant about that day? What else happened on that day in history? Any teachers know? I'd be a teacher about the only one that would know, but okay, if you remember to ask me what the answer is, if you can't think of it, otherwise I'll let Gene figure it out and tell you. Okay? See, teachers love to do that. They love to trick you. Or try to trick you. Okay, 68 is a weakness of a teacher. They may neglect practical applications. They're very much into their head. They're very much into analytical kinds of things. And because of that, they tend to be non-practical. They don't like practical things. And therefore, they tend to avoid or ignore the practical things. And most of us enjoy practical examples. And because of that, when we're listening to a teacher and they're not putting in practical examples, it gets very difficult for them, or it gets very difficult for the audience. But they're very practical. Okay, let's hurry along. One, two more. Servers. I've already told you many things about a server. The high energy level. Dropping the paper on the, what happens if I drop the paper on the floor? What would happen if I did that and there's servers in the audience? What would they do? Yeah, they'd run down there and pick it up. I'm surprised. You servers are really restraining yourself, aren't you? But aren't you starting to experience it? Aren't you starting to get agitated that that piece of paper is laying down there? Can't you feel it happen? See, it's instinctive. I'm telling you, these gifts are instinctive. They're a part of us. And the paper is laying down there, and it's even laying on its edge, and a piece of paper is not supposed to be down there, and it's most certainly not supposed to lay on its edge. And yet all these servers are in here leaving it lay there. I just cannot believe that. But what I'm wanting you to experience, you experience the feeling. You walk into your house, there's a piece of something on the floor. Or worse than that, you walk in your neighbor's house, and there's something on the floor, and you pick it up. And you know, you embarrass them. Here, you left this in the floor. Oh, gee whiz. Now, that wasn't the intent. But obviously, they're very physical people. They are very much aware of what's going on around them in a very, very physical way. Okay, the last one was giver. They're very secretive people. One of the outstanding things about giver, and since my paper's down there and it's too far down there and I don't think I can reach it, I can't rattle off any of those questions, which must be really important. I knew that would happen. I just knew it. Giver. They give freely of money. They have a tendency to make money, but they have a tremendous tendency to give money. They want to know what the needs of another person is, and they like to give, and they like to give in secret. They do not want their name put on a bulletin board saying so-and-so gave so much money or donated so much money for this fund. They hate that. Don't do that. They love to give without others knowing it. They feel delight when gift is an answer to specific prayer. I'll tell you, if you want to overjoy a giver, they give a gift to a person, and then they come to find out a little bit later that that person had been asking God about that. And there happens to be a book that was written by a giver that, I mean, it is really worth your while to buy. It is the journal of a man called George Mueller. M-U-L-L-E-R, M-U-L-L-E-R. George Mueller was a man who lived back in the 1800s. And living in the 1800s, he was a man who was very concerned about the orphans in England. And because of this concern, and he would look around and nobody was taking care of him, he wanted to start an orphanage. But being a giver, he wanted to be secretive. And so he made an agreement with the Lord. He said, "Lord, if this is a task you want me to do, then I need £1,000, or what's probably in our language, $10,000, to start this. And since nobody's got that kind of money, I don't have to worry about it." And so he waited. A year later, £1,000 came to him. And so he says, "Okay," or $10,000. And he says, "Okay, the Lord must want me to do that. I'll test the Lord again just to see. One of the things I will need to start this orphanage is a couple to come in and live with these orphans. Lord, if you send me a couple that can do this, then I know, I really know that you want me to start this orphanage." Next morning, knock on the door, according to his journal, a couple of people standing there and say, "You know, God prompted us to give our lives over to orphans, and we wonder if you have any interest in doing something in this area." He knew what the Lord wanted. Over the next 60 years, this man never advertised any need of the orphanage. Never advertised it. And yet, there was thousands of orphans that went through his homes that had a place to live besides on the streets. And he did it all through prayer. He would pray, he would tell God what a need was, didn't say a word to anybody. Somebody come knocking on the door and say, "Look, the Lord prompted me to give you this money here." It's just amazing. That's what happens with givers. That's what they like. 95, they're not gullible, difficult to be taken in. They usually make very wise investments. They're very good at making money. 91, they want their gifts to be of high quality so they will last. In fact, is when a giver gives a gift, part of their sales goes with the gift. That's why they don't give cheap gifts. So if you know anybody, a giver, and you're having a birthday coming up, you might let them know, "You know, my birthday's coming up." You might even tell them what you want. They tend to be secretive. 99, they tend to spoil their children. Weakness. They tend to spoil those people who are close to them. They enjoy bargain hunting. Oh, how they love these garage sales. Oh, they love garage sales. One from another. Okay. I need to let you ask some questions. I know you got a few by now. Questions that you have, things that you'd like for me to spell out. This is the test. This is how you take the test, the explanations for the test. Any questions that you'd like to ask me? Yes. I guess they just don't exist. No. The question she's asking is, I said firstborn, secondborn, thirdborn. What happens to 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and on and on down to 22 or 23. Well, what happens is they don't have the gifts in that kind of intensity unless God has a purpose for them and he personally intensifies that gift himself for whatever reason. In that case, it has nothing to do with the birth order. It has something to do with what God wants. But you may have a family that's, just say you have parents that have a couple of children and they wait 7 or 8 years and they have 3 more children. Well, that fifth child may really be a third born because it's been so long since the others were born. And so you have to look at those. If they're exhibiting those qualities, it may well be because of their continual birth order that is realized. But being more specific than first, second, and third, I'm going to leave you to do the research on that one. Other questions? Yes.
Is someone that's like in the helping out in different areas in the church, if they're not considered like to be, according to the test, a teacher, does that mean that person is not qualified to be like a teacher?
Excellent question. In fact, probably the last or next last session will go in great, great detail about the gifts in the church context. But it is a very important question. Just because you're not a teacher doesn't mean you're not supposed to teach. No, it does not. But one of the big problems that comes along is that sometimes the pastor of the church needs teachers, and there's not a lot of them along, and he'll go around and he'll find this server sitting over here, and he'll say, "You're a teacher." And the server doesn't want to be a teacher. So they'll drag them up there, "You're a teacher." And they're very uncomfortable in the position. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes this also happens. It happened with me. I hate knocking on doors. I hate knocking on doors in that form of ministry. Prophets, givers, and mercies love it. Exhorters hate it. Okay. Anyway, 30 years ago, my wife and I went to Philadelphia to knock on doors. You know what I'm talking about when I talk about evangelism, right? Knocking on doors. I hated every minute of it. I wasn't a prophet, I wasn't a mercy, and I wasn't a giver. Those three people love doing that kind of thing. And if you got a knocking on door ministry or evangelism of that kind, a wise pastor will pick those three people to go do it. Those three people also do one other thing, they do better than the rest of them. Those three gifts make excellent prayer warriors. The best prayer warriors you ever find is a prophet, the mercy, the giver. And in that last session, we'll go into great detail. A very good question. Any other questions? Anybody? Let's go one over here. You see, it's like I told you before. You ask a question and you get information that's usually quite... You can't ask a dumb question. Yes?
There's a lawyer that works where I do, and we went to a luncheon today. And he was giving these scenarios, and it was really kind of neat because he was saying... And I mean, there's like 10 or 12 of us around this table, and he's a Christian. He's a very devout Christian, but he was saying... Okay, there's two men that need a heart transplant. They come up for it at the same time. One's a 25-year-old prisoner convicted of murder. The other one is a 70-year-old retired policeman that smoked all of his life. So which one gets the heart? So he's asking all of us this, and you should have seen the responses. It's like this thing up here. Mm-hmm. And I spoke up and I told him, I said, "You're getting the responses from all these people's different gifts, Christian or non-Christian, whatever." And I said, "This man that is teaching us on this said that we have these gifts when we are, you know, in the mother's womb." He said, "Well, I've never heard of such a thing." And he said, "I want some scriptures about this." And so that's what I was wondering, if you could give me some scriptures about it.
Right. What I will do in some of the next sessions is relate more and more to biblical passages that get involved with it. The answer is yes and no. There's some things that we learn through experience. As you've listened to what I've said, you've identified. It's something that you've identified with. It's something that you see. It's something that you can feel and experience. And there are some things in life that we just have to go on that basis for. And if you don't, then you look at those passages in Romans 12 and you see some other passages in Peter and you say, "What in the world does this mean? I don't know what a server is. I don't know what a teacher is." If we, it's somewhere along the way, we have to take some things on faith. And some of the later sessions, I will try and give some passages that illustrate that more and more. But I would never be able to present it in a way that he would accept it unless you first tell him, "I hold two doctorates." And then he says, "Oh, I'd like to hear about that." Okay. As far as that ends the sessions for tonight, we'll be meeting, I think we start at 8:30 in the morning. And I really, really enjoyed you being here. I really appreciate your questions. And be looking forward to tomorrow. Thank you.